The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McKeonis. I'd like to welcome back to the program today Julia Keller. She joins us on the phone in Chicago. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Vic. How are you?
Excellent, Julia. You have a new novel out. It's in the Bell Elkins series. It's called Bone on Bone. How many is this now?
This is number 7, and there will be even more after this. I'm just relentless. There's no stopping me, Vic.
Well, the last couple of books, we've really been immersing ourselves in an epic tragedy that's been unfolding in coal country. This must really be something that is on your mind.
You know, it is. I first became aware of the opioid addiction crisis in 2012, right before I began writing the first book. And I think as you and I have discussed in the past, I was really astonished at the transformation of the state of West Virginia in general. Appalachia, of course, but also in my hometown, Huntington, West Virginia. It's just a different place, and people who still live there, and they agreed, and I thought, what better place to set a series of novels that would chronicle the people who are trying desperately to fight this epidemic that has moved in and is just absolutely hollowing out these communities.
You set these stories primarily in Acres Gap, West Virginia. I assume this is an imaginary place?
It is. It's very like Huntington has a small town just up the river called Guyandot, which is much older than Huntington, and I kind of based it a bit on Guyandot, West Virginia. But yes, Acres Gap itself is fictional. I was afraid of too much of a one-to-one. You know, if I named actual places, if it was Beckley or Bluefield or indeed even Huntington, I was afraid that people wouldn't then try to make the one-on-one calculation, you know, with the sheriff and the prosecutor and all that. And fiction needs to stay fiction, just like fact needs to stay fact. So that was why I made that determination.
Mm. Bell Elkins is a very unusual character. And I think for readers, let's say, who read some of the earlier books and then maybe haven't read some of the more recent ones, if they open this one up, they're going to be in for a bit of a surprise as to where Bell has ended up in her life.
Yes, much has happened to her. And, of course, it's hard for me to even envision somebody not having read the more recent ones, but I'll take your point, hypothetically. I want things to happen to her as they often do in real life. You know, I read a lot of series fiction. I love a great series, mystery or otherwise. And it seems to me, though, the only problem I have with some of it is not enough happens to people as it does in real life. I mean, people undergo great cataclysmic changes in their lives, and I think sometimes that's not reflected in a fictional series, because if people have like kind of a good thing going, they sort of keep it. But Belle, as you know, discovers a truth about herself and about her past that she has to reckon with, and at the beginning of Bone on Bone, she has just completed a 3-year prison sentence. I like each of the books to stand alone, so it means you don't have to have read any of the previous 6 to enjoy and know what's happening in Bone on Bone, but it does help to know a bit about her backstory, to know how we got here. But she is indeed no longer prosecutor. She's been disbarred, of course, with a felony conviction, and she has to start her life anew, and the question being, does she stay here in this beleaguered city where it's filled with people she loves but with problems that she knows all too well, or start out somewhere new?
I guess I was referring to those readers that treat these as standalones and maybe had just like not read the one right before it or...
Right. Yes. No, I was just teasing. I think, you know, what I enjoy is to find a new series writer I didn't know, and I'm reading, it might be 12th or 13th, and then know that I have the delicious pleasure in store for me of going back at number one. And so, you know, I think with Sue Grafton, I started out with... you know, N is for Noose or something, and then went back and started with A is for Alibi, and it was just so wonderful to kind of go back and fill in the part. So that's something else I like about a series. You know, you can move forward or backward or read any of the volumes on their own, and if it's a good series, you'll get an equal amount of pleasure and gratification from just the one or from the all.
I love it that you mentioned the late Sue Grafton, because a moment ago when you talked about how you like to shake things up and not keep the series kind of in the same place, I immediately pictured Kinsey Millhone stuck in the 80s.
Yes. You know, it's funny. I just finished the last one that she did, you know, before her just a really shocking death. I mean, I didn't know she was ill. But even more than that, you know, when a writer dies, you just have this sense of like, oh, no. I mean, you do feel like you know them. You don't, of course, not personally. But I just felt so close to Kinsey. And, of course, if you love Kinsey, then you have to love Sue Grafton and assume that you would have loved her in real life. So, yeah, the fact that it's in the 80s, I think, gives it a really wonderful kind of a tenor to it. I know when I was reading this latest one, The Why Is for Yesterday, I was so struck by that, the 80s parts, that you don't have, you know, cell phones on every corner and everybody using PCs, and she still takes her notes on index cards. And there's something just delightfully anachronistic about that.
I love that, too. No text messages.
Yes.
We have them in Bone on Bone, however. There are some text messages in here. Tell us about Belle, for those of us out there listening who maybe haven't read any of these books. Who is Belle?
She is – the Belle, first, is short for Belfa, which was my great-aunt's name. And every time I talk about the books in any venue, I always ask people, has anybody ever heard the name before? And sometimes they think I'm saying Belva, B-E-L-V-A, which is a little more common. But no one ever in all these years of writing the books has ever heard of Belfa. And indeed, my great-aunt, her name was Belfa Harshbarger, I asked her – she passed away recently, and she was in her early 90s – where her parents got the name Belfa, and she says, I don't know. She always wondered as well. So Belle is short for Belfa. She grew up in Acres Gap. She was very, very poor. Her mother died when she was young, and her father was murdered. Her sister was in prison, so she grew up in foster care. She gets a fancy law degree from Georgetown, and then, to the surprise of everyone who knows her, she decides to return to Acres Gap. She has read about some of the terrible problems that are besieging it, and she decides to make her way back to this place that she had worked so assiduously to never come back to. She wanted Acres Gap in her rearview mirror, and here she is. She runs for prosecutor, and she's a fierce, fierce warrior on behalf of law and justice and what she thinks of as the right and the good. And she solves mysteries along the way, but she also has a great mystery brewing in her own past. So, as I mentioned, this mystery comes back to her in book 6, Fast Falls the Night, which is the immediate predecessor to this one, Bone on Bone. And she serves some time in a low-security prison. And that is a real place in Alderson, West Virginia. And you may know the very famous person who served time there as well. Do you know the celebrity that was that served time in Alderson? You might know this.
I don't. I had never heard of Alderson, so I do not.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, if you are a People magazine reader, you will have heard of it. Martha Stewart.
Oh, no. Oh, my.
Served her time there. So Belle has just come out of that, and she's returning to Acres Gap and deciding, as I said at the outset, whether she should stay or not, or is this a time to make a break and really make a change in her life?
I liked that bio that you did for her, because just that those three words, her father was murdered. I like that. Well done, Julia.
Well, that's the thing.
I understand. Yeah.
Still secrets there. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I do love a good plot twist. You know, it's one thing I really admire. The mystery writers I admire, I love, of course, their style, their literary style. But boy, somebody that can concoct a great plot with twists that seem that come out of nowhere but also are completely plausible, that to me is, and I think you and I have talked about this in the past, that those are the ones that you truly admire. Dennis Lehane, I think, is great at that. Anne Cleves, the great British mystery writer. I always say that the end of a mystery should strike you as how your first thought should be, I never saw that coming, and your second thought almost simultaneous should be, but of course.
Well, I like getting to the end of the mystery and thinking I've got it all figured out, and then just having the rug yanked out from under me as they throw in one of those twists.
Yes. Yeah. But they have to be earned, don't you think? I mean, that's the great thing. My only slight – now, here I am. Who am I to criticize Agatha Christie, the great Agatha Christie, who I admire, actually, her style as much as anything. But sometimes the solution will be dependent upon a piece of information. It's kind of unfair. You didn't have the full information. That's the only slight criticism I would have of of the great Dame Agatha is that sometimes she doesn't exactly play fair with the reader, but the ones that do, when you, again, you have those simultaneous emotions of complete astonishment and just great gratification of like, it couldn't be any other way.
Mm. Yeah, there's really a great pleasure in that. At 3 a.m. when you turn that last page and just go, now I understand why I stayed up so late to finish this book.
Yes, yes. And how about the opposite feeling, though? You know, when you get to the end and you don't feel like they've quite done it. It was either too obvious, you figured it out, you know, 40 pages ago, or it really is just not an earned surprise. They pulled a rabbit out of the hat one too many times, and it's like, well, you didn't tell me that he served in the French Foreign Legion in 1920, or I would have figured it out, you know.
And in the dead of winter, I have the satisfaction of lobbing that book into the fire.
Yeah. Exactly. That reminds me, a great line in a Dorothy Parker review once, she said, this is not a book to be set aside lightly. This is one to be flung across the room in utter frustration.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, Julia Keller has returned to the program. Her new novel is Bone on Bone, and we have Belle, who has just gotten out of jail, and she's kind of having to rehabilitate herself. She's doing community service. She's doing menial labor. And just across town, her former colleague, Deputy Jake Oakes, is dealing with his own issues and his own attempts at rehabilitation. And I love the way you have these parallel paths.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Jake sort of sneaked up on me. I didn't expect to like him as much as I did. In Fast Falls the Night, he sort of emerged as his own character. He, as you know, has an unrequited love for an EMT, an African-American woman, and that's quite an anomaly in West Virginia. It's one of the least diverse states in the country, and African-Americans very much stand out there, and it's a difficult life sometimes, you know, when you don't look like everybody else, and this is something that Molly has to fight. But Jake himself was at a very perilous crossroads in his life at the end of Fast Falls the Night, and we find out that he was indeed gravely injured from an assailant's bullet. He is now in a wheelchair, and he too must start his life anew. And as you say, I mean, there is a parallel to what Belle is having to do. He is physically challenged now in the way that she is emotionally and spiritually challenged, and they have to find their paths. And as I said, he just kind of sneaked up on me. And their romance, Jake's romance with Molly, was something else I really didn't see coming. But as I was writing, it just seemed to be there. It just seemed to be kind of off to the side a little bit, right in the corner of my eye. And I thought, ah, of course, that's what needs to happen there.
And he was a guy who, like Belle, was very much a powerful force, a guy who had no doubts, who forged forward, who was totally confident. And now, suddenly, he's feeling sorry for himself, and this is a real change for him.
Yes, I like the way you put that, a guy who had no doubt. That's the thing. I mean, I think we need that in our law enforcement. I mean, you have to have a confident law enforcement person. That's what we need. But on the other hand, it does breed a kind of, what would I say, maybe an overconfidence at times. And there he was. He kind of had the world because he was a deputy sheriff in this county. He was an authority figure, loved his job, loved chasing the bad guys just as Belle did. And so suddenly now it's all changed. It's all different. And to come to terms with this vastly altered reality, I can't even imagine what kind of a challenge that is. I mean, we all have setbacks in our lives. We all have things not go the way that we hoped they would. But to have such a massive reversal of fortune and then have to kind of pick up the shards of a life that has exploded in front of your eyes is a challenge that is really unimaginable in its dimensions to me. And that's why I wanted to have Jake be facing this. And he and Belle, of course, team up. And this is kind of where the series is going at this point. She's not a prosecutor anymore, so she has to find another way to try to fight the addiction crisis that is very complex. That's something I try to talk about in the books, too, and particularly this book. It isn't a simple thing. I mean, people always want to find a simple answer to these great social problems, and it's not simple. It's you know, the economic blight that's in a lot of these areas that have been hard hit. It's the overprescribing of the opioids. It's the misunderstanding of how ferociously addictive they can be. It's our healthcare policy. It's our lack of adequate resources for rehabilitation. I mean, it's so complex that it can kind of cause you to just throw up your hands and say, I'm out. I can't deal with this. And that's something Bell has to fight as well, despair and cynicism in the wake of this problem.
The novel is Bone on Bone, and I'm talking to Julia Keller about this latest book in the series. All right, let's talk about the crime. Tell them about the crime. They're all wondering, well, what's the gist of this? What's the crime?
Yeah, a dead body.
Yeah.
No, you know, that's one thing I do, and you and I have talked about this as well. It is true of crime fiction. I mean, something bad has to happen, something truly grievously bad, a murder, a death, something really awful. And that's why I think I kind of like crime fiction itself, because it's a kind of the stakes are very high, and it's a place where we can explore all these great issues of life and death and truth and justice and all that, but at a very high level, not like a philosophical, you know, graduate school seminar, but right on the street where there's a dead body, there's a chalk outline, and you have to deal with it in the immediate moment. The local banker, a man named Brett Topping, upstanding local citizen, is murdered in his driveway by an unknown person, shot dead. And the issue is he and his wife have been struggling for some time with their son, Tyler Topping, who is a teenager, began to be involved in the drug life. One point I wanted to make in the novel is that this isn't just, you know, poor, downtrodden people who are affected by this. This is people from good homes with, you know, good, involved parents, as Tyler Topping had. And even with all that, he still becomes addicted to drugs and becomes just kind of a menace, kind of a slouching menace around the neighborhood. The parents don't know what to do. I mean, what do you do? I know some people who are in this situation as parents. You see a child who is suffering from addiction, who won't get help, and if you do get them help, if they are not involved in it, then that's not going to work. You can't go to rehab unwillingly and have it ever work. So, of course, suspicion falls upon Tyler. Suspicion falls upon the dealer, the drug dealer in the area that he's been working with. It falls in various places. All we know is that Brett and Ellie Topping have been dealing with this, the great sadness, the great disappointment of their lives as their sons become an addict, and that Brett now lies dead with three bullets in his chest in his driveway.
Tyler, you do a splendid job of depicting him as this loathsome creature, just totally enthralled to his addiction. Horrible, repulsive to look at, to hear him speak. He's disrespectful. He's just this parasite. And yet, by the end of the book, we like him. Splendid. Splendid that you could make us do that.
I'm so glad to hear that, because I think that's so important, that sometimes when people are overcome by an addiction, it can be drugs or alcohol or any of the other things that kind of get hold of us, we are transformed, but that doesn't mean that we're irredeemable. And that's exactly right. I kind of wanted to show that journey. Here's a good kid from a good home. He falls down this well of his addiction, and he is enthralled to it. He's a different person. They don't know what to do. Their lives are completely upended, the lives of his parents. But hopefully by the end of the book, we realize that it's that there is hope. I mean, there has to be some hope. You know, I got a letter from a woman that lives in the area that I write about. I've gotten many, many letters about this book, more so than the previous ones. I'm not exactly sure why, but I think she might have put her finger on it. She said, there is hope in this book. And then you could tell she kind of like was shaking her head as she was writing this email. And she said, I don't know why there is, because I feel hopeless. I see drug deals on my streets, the streets of a town where I've lived my whole life, and I can't believe it. But she said, Belle has hope, and Jake has hope, and there is hope in this book. And that surprised me, she said, and I want more of it. I want to figure out how Belle gets her hope. I thought that was a really kind of extraordinarily unique way of looking at a piece of mystery fiction, of what is an entertainment. I mean, novel is an entertainment, but it can also be not just that. So I take your point about Tyler, and I hope that people can see that as well. Now, he's not out of the woods, of course. I mean, it's a long, long road, and many people end up going to rehab dozens and dozens of times. That's something else I've discovered just in the research I do for these books. It's not unusual for someone to go many, 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 many times before it takes, if it takes at all.
And when Tyler feels dope sick and he's feeling withdrawal. He's willing to do just about anything, including some really stupid things to try to get that next fix. And I hate to mention anybody else's new book, but I'm wondering, have you read Dope Sick by Beth Macy?
You know, I've read of it. I haven't read the entire book yet, and I do know her work. I read her previous two books as well, and I've heard her interviewed about it. I'm glad we're doing books like that. I will tell you, though, I'm a little my concern is that it has gotten such attention, not her book particularly, but just this whole issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I began writing about it in 2012, it was just coming onto the national radar. We had wonderful books like Dreamland, I say wonderful / terrible. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of attention that was gradually coming to it, and now every newspaper, every magazine, every TV show has done a story on it. And we're almost to that point, you know, they talk about compassion fatigue, and that's my only concern. You know, I was down in Huntington recently doing a little research with some people I wanted to talk to down there, and the police chief down there was telling me, he said, you know, we had U.S. News and World Report, we had Time Magazine, we've had the Washington Post, you know, the New York Times has practically moved into the, you know, the local Holiday Inn, and he was kind of rolling his eyes, meaning, okay, enough. Now we've all identified the problem. It's a terrible problem. All right, what now?
Mm-hmm.
What now? And I'm not sure we need any more identification of the problem is all, you know, and I worry about that in my own books, too. It's like, all right, everybody knows it's there. Now what do we do? And as you know, there's a section in Bone on Bone where Belle's having a conversation with Rhonda Lovejoy, her former assistant and protege, who now is the acting prosecutor, and Belle comes up with some solutions, some ideas. Now, Rhonda doesn't really hold with any of them, and she's not particularly impressed with them, but I wanted to suggest at least a few things where you can say, all right, how do we begin coming out of it now? We're down in the well. How do we come out of it? How do we scale those dank sides of that well and get out of it? It's time to be doing that. So, but yes, I am aware of Beth Macy's work. I'm a big admirer of her journalism. But I do, and as you know, there are documentaries now, the Netflix documentary Heroin, which is set in Huntington, my hometown. And there's another one that the same filmmakers just recently released, and it's set around the Morgantown and Wheeling areas. It's called Recovery Boys, about some young men who are addicted and who go to a very unique rehab program set on a farm in West Virginia. It's an amazing documentary. If any of your listeners have Netflix, well worth a look.
For whatever reason, maybe because they're in a boring little town and there's nothing else going on, they get snared up in this world of drugs, or maybe they hurt themselves playing sports, or whatever the reason, they get sucked into this. And sometimes it's the kids where you think that the family's perfect and these kids are perfect, and then you realize the darkness behind the curtain. And her book has a lot of that in it. And I thought of your book and I thought of her book together in that way. And I had a funny conversation recently it wasn't funny, but it surprised me. I was talking to a writer who's also on the same imprint you are, Minotaur, and she has a crime series set in Columbus, Kristen Lepianka, and she recently published her second book, and I asked her about her third book, and she said she had pitched it to, I guess it would be her editor at Minotaur, and it was going to have the opioid crisis as a central theme, and they said, no, we don't want you to do that. There's apparently some fatigue in the editor's chairs, too, over this issue.
Oh, I've not heard that, but that makes sense. I mean, and what a shame, because I'm sure the perspective she would bring would be very unique. So
I think she was.
That's the attitude.
Yeah, I think she was surprised. And they told her, well, Julia Keller's got that covered. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you back off. She'll come after you. Yeah. No. I mean, I think that's exactly, I appreciate you telling that story, because that's exactly what I mean. When you get to the point when you think, okay, we know all about that. It used to happen, you know, in story meetings. I was a journalist for a number of years, and like the Chicago Tribune, we'd have a story meeting, and you'd bring up a topic, and an editor would say, oh, no, we've covered that. And I'd say, what do you mean we've covered it? What does that mean? Just because we've said it's out there? What is that? We haven't covered it? I took their point. I know what they were saying, but on the other hand, there is always something new to say about the human condition, and these subjects are eternally part of the human condition. Issues like addiction and how all of us fall short of the people that we know we can be.
Well, Julia, for those of us who have been enjoying your series, it's reassuring to us later on in the book when a character who was her mentor and kind of a father figure to her becomes involved, and we think, you know, it's all going to turn out okay.
Well, at the end of the day, there almost has to be a little of that. You know, the steady diet of total darkness is really leads nowhere. And we've got to, just to keep with my metaphor that I just plucked out of the blue today, that climbing out of the well. I mean, at some point, we have to believe that there is a brighter dawn. You know, a friend of mine who has had some addiction struggles as well said to me, and I thought it was such a good point, she said, I have to believe, and it's true, you can change everything about your life in the next minute. You can change in the next 5 minutes. You can change tomorrow morning. That's the one great gift we are all given. Rich or poor, black or white, male or female, tall or short, we all have that the next moment can be that hinge point. The next moment can be the threshold to a new and better life. And if we believe that, it's that, you know, it's like the William James line, you know, the first act of belief is to believe in belief. If you believe you have that, then we can go to that brighter day. And I know that sounds incredible, you know, incredibly Pollyannish and sort of naive and silly and optimistic and all that, but no complete cynic would ever write a line. I mean, writers have to be optimists, or else why would we bother? So I try to convey that in my books as well, that as bad as things are, and they are bad, make no mistake, they're terrible, but there is tomorrow. There is that new dawn, there is that new day, and there are people, like there are the real-life equivalents of the fictional Belle and Jake and Nick and Molly, who are fighting as hard as they can to make things different in Appalachia.
Mm. My guest is Julia Keller. Her book is Bone on Bone. What books have you read lately that you really liked?
Oh, let's see. You know, I've got a big stack of them. Of course, I always love Kate Atkinson.
Mm.
I know she has a new one out, which I haven't read yet, but mm-hmm. her backlist is quite wonderful. The book that I've been raving about a lot is a book called A Partial History of Lost Causes by a woman named Jennifer Du Bois. I know nothing about her. I just know that it was just a wonderful, wonderful book, bit of a mystery, parallel story set in contemporary Russia and the contemporary United States.
Uh-huh.
Love that book very much. I'm trying to think. I just have begun Autumn, the book by Ali Smith, the British writer.
Mm-hmm.
I usually have a stack of about 20 books at once to read. I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, and they're all different genres, but for some reason, my soul just needs that, you know, to constantly be shifting between stories. I'm trying to think of what else. I'm visualizing the stack that I have in front of me. I mentioned the last Sue Grafton novel, the unfortunately last one, Why Is for Yesterday. I'm rereading a collection of essays that I adore, and I think it's one of the great essay collections of our time, by Timothy Ferris, called Coming of Age in the Milky Way.
Huh.
You may know that one.
Mm.
Just the whole history of our exploration of the cosmos, written in such an accessible form. Again, it's one of those books that, despite the kind of long tunnel of hopelessness that the human experience seems to embody, we are always looking up. And it's that looking up at the night sky or the next day's dawn that keeps us going and really distinguishes us.
Well, apparently Jake Oakes is a Michael Conley fan. I thought
that's right. I love mentioning real authors,
uh-huh.
you know, in a, just like real TV shows. And yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
that,
I like
indeed.
That.
Well, he would be. You know, a friend of mine, she's a great reader, but her husband wasn't. And she said, I just can't get him to read any fiction. He was going on a long business trip to Europe. And I said, well, so I said, go buy him a couple of Michael. She said, he won't read fiction. I said, just try it. Just go. And, of course, you can imagine what happens next. He calls her from Europe, and he says, I want you to go out and buy all of them for me. The two that, I mean, he couldn't put them down. He loved them.
Oh, wow.
He's now, you know, the greatest Michael Conley. And I love that story because it's like, it's just getting the right book. It's not, you know, it's not just reading in general, but getting the right book for the right reader. And you're probably like me. You probably spend a good deal of your time doing book matchmaking.
Mm. Well, Julia, it's really been a pleasure having you back on the program.
Yes, this is wonderful, Vic. Always enjoy it.
My guest has been Julia Keller. Her new one is Bone on Bone for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.